The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buebert, retired army officer and a regular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. Today, I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together. Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 67, The Mountains of Madness, Military Defeat and Terrain, Part 2. A little bit of housekeeping. Since I started this podcast, both Chasing Ghosts and War Notes, I've gotten some response from listeners, thank you very much, with constructive criticism and comments concerning audio quality. Well, I've taken that bull by the horns. I've retained the services of Chris Williams at Podsworth. And what I plan on doing is taking the entire catalog and running it through his system to perfect and better manipulate the sound so that it is optimized for all my listeners. So that being the case, let me know what you think. I have not started on Chasing Ghost Catalog episode 1 through the one prior to this, but the one you're listening to right now has been run through Chris Williams' Black Box, and I am most thankful for that. It's not free. It costs money. It's an investment in my podcast to make it better and better all the time. So you'll see in the show notes where if you're interested in doing this very thing, love some feedback from you guys to let me know what you think. And also, while I tend to be mostly historical and speculative when it comes to future conflict, using that historical basis, I tend not to concentrate on contemporaneous conflict, excepting larger ones that call themselves into being because of the subject that I may be tackling in a given episode. I'm finding that in this case, with the result of events that are occurring in Iran, that it sort of demands of me my observations on this topic. I will stand on the shoulders of giants like Douglas McGregor and John Mearsheimer, who have far more knowledge about this very thing. And I would urge all of you to listen to their opinions and extrapolation on what's going on in Iran now, what has gone on in Iran since 1953, if you're interested in looking at the history of the whole thing, and of course, since 1979, which has animated so many presidents to square themselves directly against Iran and Iraq, to include the subsidy of Iraq fighting Iran for 8 years from 1980 to 1988 in a full-throated conventional conflict. And then, of course, we find America finds itself invading that same Iraq a mere 3 years later. And then, of course, a mere 12 years later. The wheels turn and the wheels turn again. And this is simply the way American foreign policy seems to be, a never-ending wrecking ball that in the end finds itself wrecking itself. So we'll continue on. And also, I think that some of the speculation, opinions, and historiographical observations that I have may lose me some listeners. That is the risk that all of us as conflict observers take, in that we may find ourselves ruffling the feathers of people who have pre-existing conceptions on conflict around the world, in which they have invested themselves, despite their bias filters telling them otherwise, in countries that may be biting off far more than they can chew. As I spoke to in part one of this particular, what turns into an episode series, I talk about the troubles that are involved in fighting mountainous conflicts. In this case, it appears that the co-conspirators in the West, Israel, the U.S., and their satraps, think that through air superiority, dominance, and the use of missiles in a missile duel at an existential level, can quite literally level Iran and convince them to come to the bargaining table. Although we've seen in the past week where during the time that Iranian envoys were at the bargaining table, Some of them perished as a result of being at said bargaining table, which doesn't bode well for future negotiations, not only with Iran, but any of the BRICS countries, because their perception of the United States and the Western allies is that even in peaceful negotiations, they may not be acting in good faith. I have the largest faith that the change of regime in Washington, D.C. would pursue something that was on par with what I consider the brilliant diplomacy road tour of the Trump administration with the Abraham Accords, and finding through very hard work and pounding on tables and meeting and communicating with all the different factions throughout the Middle East, that they were finally, after decades, hammering something of a workable peace out. All of that was shattered by the last administration from 2020 to 2024. And I had hopes, forlorn, it turns out, that the administration would take up the cudgel of what it sought to do with the Abraham Accords and do so without raising the war hammer, or unfortunately, raising as an R-A-Z-I-N-G, what has happened in Gaza and other places. For an old hand who spends a lot of time looking at irregular warfare as an umbrella rubric for resistance and nation states that have been invaded, if anything has occurred, for the most part, it is that the Israelis have sealed the deal in their constant war in the region to cement the will and make concrete generations who will oppose everything that the Israelis do, not only outside their borders, but within their borders, and that the specter of terrorism is not reduced or zeroed out, but simply ratcheted up to a level that I suspect in the near future, and I don't desire this, but will render the Israeli state a moot point through their own behavior. The Israelis have always been a paper tiger ever since 1967 and 1973. In 1973, when they found themselves in extremis, they had to reach out to their stalwart United States ally for materiel support and ISR intelligence support and reconnaissance so that they could sustain the conflict and best the League of Nations that had taken up arms against them and tried to wipe them off the map. They survived that. But since that time, this paper tiger, yet another paper tiger, smaller in scale and dwarf and wolf than the United States, has found itself in 1982 defeated, in 2000 defeated, in 2006 in Lebanon defeated, according to their own Weizengrad report, which was issued in 2007 on just how badly the Israeli army and air force had fared during that conflict. And it goes on and on. And of course, we run up the flag October 7th, 2023, with the invasion of irregular elements from Gaza into Israel and the resulting disproportionate response by the Israeli armed forces, helped out by many of their allies and supporters globally through logistics, materiel, ISR, and monetary support, to conduct what is essentially a scorched earth campaign on the Palestinians. Whatever you may think of them or wish upon them, that is a fact. The Israelis have consistently been picking a fight, even though they allegedly fight as a martial enterprise, above their weight, which I think is a myth, which is being proved out as we speak. Whether it is the installation of an Al-Qaeda operative into the throne at the top of Syria, or their consistent and constant war on the Shia Crescent, and their consistent and constant embrasure, toleration, or even alliance with the Wahhabist Sunni monster in Saudi Arabia, they have made a pact with the devil, and by extension, anybody who finds themselves in league with Israel has done the same. It is not my belief that Israel is an evil entity in and of itself. That is not an opinion for me to render, but my opinion is the same one that as I hold with the Ukraine and Russia. It is not in the U.S. interest to fight there, because I happen to be not an isolationist, but a non-interventionist. I think that when one exports violence abroad, the second and third order effects of that are always much worse than any intention that was posited. And that, as we know with all empires, whatever an empire does abroad, and America is certainly an empire, that empire will bring all of that home. And we have seen that manifest itself in the United States. So we can fast forward to the last month. I am recording this podcast within 48 hours of the alleged U.S. bombing of, I put in air quotes here, nuclear fabrication facilities in Israel. And I find myself highly skeptical of anything the current administration is saying about said attack on Iran. And I'm also thinking that what Iran may very well do is submit their three-month notice to withdraw, this is Article 10 of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and agree to rejoin as soon as Israel becomes a signatory to the NPT and inspections commence. Iran can cite extraordinary events for the withdrawal. I think that when your country's nuclear facilities, whether it is for peace or ill, are attacked by a third world alliance of nations, that certainly qualifies as extraordinary events. Is there a precedent for withdrawal from NPT? Of course there is. North Korea already formally withdrew from the NPT on 10 January 2003, while Article 10 requires 3 months. Theirs was effective the very next day on the 11th of January, 2003. And what the North Koreans have broken the code on, as have the Pakis in Pakistan and other smaller nuclear nation states. Remember, South Africa was one of the only nuclear nation states to disarm and dismantle its nuclear capability. Mind you, there was a test fire, a test blast of their atomics in 1977, over the Southern Atlantic, proving that they had the capability. Most likely, that South African capability was a result of their coalition and collaboration with Israel and developing that technology and being able to execute it. Again, the West plays a very dangerous game here, because what the West is essentially saying through Israel or vice versa is that if you have nuclear ambitions, we will do everything we can to crush said nuclear ambitions, even though any savvy dictator or not dictator on any nation state on earth knows that the way to avoid a U.S. direct or proxy invasion or influence in your country is to possess said nuclear weapons so that you will be left the frack alone as an autonomous nation state. Are the Iranians developing nuclear weapons? It's possible. The fissionable material requirements for weaponization versus the peaceful use of nuclear power to provision energy are quite different and quite a bit more expensive when it comes to weaponization thereof. And it also means that you have to have a very sophisticated bevy of delivery vehicles that have a CEP, a circular error of probability, at the conclusion of their thousands-mile journey on a steep parabola to land where you tell it to land and to blast things with that radiological and nuclear blast once it lands. Arguably speaking, when one looks at the entire inventory of nuclear weapons planet-wide, which peaked decades ago at north of 50,000 weapons, to what is essentially maybe 12,000 nuclear weapons. And let's remember that all retired nuclear weapons, for the most part, have some kind of numbering when it comes to Russia and the U.S., according to the START Treaty. And they possess, I think it's something like 90% of all atomic munitions stockpiles planet-wide, whether that's gravity bombs, cruise missiles, intermediate-range ballistic missiles, or intercontinental ballistic missiles. The last two, of course, and I've said this over and over again in my podcast, and for those of you new to this podcast, know that hypervelocity munitions incoming have been a phenomenon since the 1950s, and that for the most part, no country on Earth has a fail-safe and 100% effective alternative to engaging that munition or set of munitions once it reaches apogee and it's on its way, whether terminally maneuvering or terminally ballistic. It is a very difficult enterprise to intercept that, and not only intercept it and destroy it in flight, but intercept it and destroy it in flight so that you do not detonate said nuclear weapon, even though there are a lot of the fail-safes in first-world nuclear weapons that render them inert even if hit. Again, wheels within wheels in this kind of nuclear game of chicken that the West is currently engaged in with nuclear powers, whether that be Pakistan or whether that be Russia or whether that be China. And now they're beginning the nuclear chicken game with Iran. The other thing, if you embrace John Mearsheimer's ideas of realpolitik, which I happen to subscribe to, I think that he sees all the world's national actors in the anarchic realm of international relations as both rational and less than rational players who have their own self-interest in mind with what motivates them to do whatever they want to do. In this case, Iran, with a population of 92 million souls, if they take it upon themselves, and in this case it would be the Iranian government, to arm themselves with nuclear weapons, and for most of my adult life, I will say the last three decades, I've been told again and again by the numbskulls in the coprophile media that they are days, weeks, or months away from achieving nuclear weapons capability. Now, is that conjoined with delivery capability? They're rather opaque about that. Well, frankly, that's because they don't know. In this case, as I mentioned, Israel turns out to be a paper tiger in so many ways. There's a reason why Israel is presently trying to make illegal any photos or videos of missile flight in Israeli airspace. This could be for several reasons. Number one, the Golden Dome is not quite what they supposed it was. And of course, there is the raw and real numbers game that you can loft as many of these high technology interceptor devices as you wish, but it is real hard to reconstitute, refit, and make better all of your ammunition magazines that support all of that defensive realm. And the West, and the US in particular, whether it's the THAAD, the Patriot, the HIMARS, or any of the other missile interceptor modalities in the entire constellation of integrated air and missile defense that the U.S. and West, and by extension Israel, have been employing, many were sent since the Russians found themselves in the Ukraine in their invasion, sent there to be employed, and the Russians have been carefully taking notes on what that employment of the Western IAMD apparatus looks like, how to defeat it, what the numbers of reconstitution look like. And the bad news is that Western magazines of highly sophisticated missiles and missile interceptors are rather low as we speak. Can we go into specific numbers? Of course we can. We can find some of those numbers, but who knows what the real numbers are. So we're simply going to speculate here. And I'm going to stipulate that magazines have not been replenished at the rates that one would find appropriate when the larder is being emptied at the astonishing rate that it has in the Ukraine, and now by what Israel is using to defend itself against what is apparently thousands of incoming IRBMs, ICBMs, missile volleys, and even UAVs, FPVs, and long-range drones that have been launched by Iran in response to Israeli launches against Iran proper. Per those nuclear weapons, Stockholm International Peace Research Institute did a recent study, I think it was released in June of this year, that more than 12,000 nuclear weapons exist in the world, owned by 9 states. A large portion of these weapons are possessed by the U.S. and Russia, as I mentioned earlier. The U.S., 5,177. Russia, 5,459. The United Kingdom, 225. France, 290, Israel, 90, Pakistan, 170, India, 180, China, 600, North Korea, 50. Let that burn into your memory. North Korea, 50. A nation state that can barely feed itself, but has decided, under a communist mantle, that allows itself through central planning and militaristic societal forming to find the wherewithal to develop 50 nuclear weapons. By the way, 50 nuclear weapons attached to a dazzling array and series of launchable rocketry that allows them to send it thousands of miles away if they wish. You will note that as a result of that, North Korea doesn't get fracked with very often. Of those 9, only 7 of them are members of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. North Korea and Israel, North Korea having resigned, as I mentioned earlier, in 2003, and of course, Israel being the exceptional nation on Earth, was never a signatory in the first place. As in the previous episode, I would call your attention to the size of Iran. It is the 17th largest country on Earth. It is comprised of 636,000 square miles. Take a look at a map, and if you look at the map of it compared to Iraq and Afghanistan, two of the recent failed adventures of the American military machine, in which no control north to south, east to west, was ever wrested in any of those countries during the 20 years of occupation, more so in Afghanistan than Iraq, where the American military, much less being a coalition military with many members of NATO and other countries who joined in the festivities there, could never gain control of said countries. And as I mentioned in the previous episode, for those of you who didn't listen, 2/3, from my rough guesstimate, my wild-ass guess, of Iran just so happens to be mountainous terrain. Mountainous terrain, for those who follow ground operations historically, is probably, besides urban warfare, some of the most problematic warfare when it comes to besting resistance forces or even conventional forces that find themselves nested in those areas. For instance, if you look at the northern mountain stretches during the Vietnam War against both the French and the U.S., what was sort of an archipelago war, mind you, and this is a term that the North Vietnamese state used, when you combined this archipelago style fighting with the mountainous terrain itself, very hard to wrest and maintain control of those regions with an army of occupation and invasion. Ever since, aviation has found a footing in the U.S. martial imagination and its Western confrères. We've heard all kinds of noises about air dominance, air supremacy, air superiority, and the fact that one day, and this was posited from the 20s and 30s and 40s, but then again it was cured after World War II, there were notion by air theorists that air would be the guarantor and the sole military arm that could wrest control of rest of populations and countries that refuse to comply with external wishes by other nation states to heal, to come to heal, to obey, to force them into a compliance with a Western imposed regime, in this case, on a non-Western nation, that being Persia and Iran and the rest of it, and that compliance would come after the terroristic strategic bombing of essential assets, starting in this case with the nuclear munitions and fabrication facilities, maybe moving on to larger cities, military targeting, whatever the case may be. But when one looks at this historically, you would be very hard-pressed to find a single instance in a conflict in which air carried the day, in which air forces, whether bombers, fighters, interceptors, ground attack aircraft, whatever the case may be, were the single most malleable and superior influence in all the arrays of warfare that were needed. Of course, in this case, ground attack and infantry attack and tank attack and the possession of ground and such. Those would be the necessary ingredients to bring a nation to heel that was misbehaving, I put this in air quotes, in the perception of the Western countries. In this case, the U.S. and Israel, having thought that since Syria was now under control of the West and that so much of the Shia crescent had come somewhat to compliance with what Israeli, Western, and U.S. interests were, that now this regional hegemon, this regional superpower, if you will, Iran, would be able to be brought to heel and taught a thing or two and would kowtow, take a knee, and come into satrap-like compliance with the needs and wishes of the West. I don't think this is going to happen at all. I think that there are folks in the Department of State in the United States and in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in the UK and all over Europe, and especially the kind of militant pie-in-the-sky diplomacy that animates so much of what Israel does in the Middle East. There's a reason why that country is under a military-style governance, for the most part, why 92 to 94% of all land in Israel is owned by the Israeli government, and why so much death and destruction follows how that state conducts itself in all of its external foreign affairs, especially contiguous to the Israeli nation state itself. Again, this is not a problem that I have with Jews or Zionists or the state of Israel or anything like that. I don't have a dog in the hunt. I don't have any kind of alliance or allegiance with that country. Much like with Russia and the Ukraine, that is a fight that NATO created by its eternal eastward expansion of the NATO blob after warning after warning, after red line from Russia proper, that it would not tolerate such lack of neutrality and this increasing march to its western borders, having suffered for well over 200 years, starting with Napoleon and an interregnum with what happened at the conclusion of World War I, to what happened with Operation Barbarossa and the invasion of Russia in 1941, and every such thing that has happened since 1989 to 1991, when the Communist Project gave up the ghost in the now dead USSR to be replaced by Russia, and their constant, if not informed, paranoic stance that NATO was an ever-present threat to their sovereignty. Now, nothing helped that case, of course, when it comes to Russia, to listen to many Western leaders, especially in America, opine that what we need to do is find some way to get Putin out of power, take Russia down for task, sublimate it into many parts and pieces, and then feed off of that corpse for all the resources, rich as they do across the dozen time zones that it has to offer. Now, that kind of speak doesn't put a nation in a position where they find themselves thinking, well, maybe we can work with these people. Maybe we can negotiate. Maybe we can, through diplomatic means, find compromises and trade-offs in which we can all settle this in peace. Same thing occurs here. Yes, there has been constant Iranian nonsense when it comes to the eradication of Israel and such. I would tell you that I'm not defending them in not being evil in their regime and what they've done. But Israel, and the U.S. by extension, has played a large role in developing that kind of paranoid mystique and thinking in the Iranian mind, starting in the 1953 CIA-sponsored coup in Iran, putting in the Shah, who would go on to do some good things and many bad things, culminating in 1979 with an Islamic revolution, in this case a Shia Islamic revolution, that would make Iran into yet another Islamic authoritarian nation-state. So in no way am I offering an apologia for Iran and Israel's behavior in a martial sense or in a saber-rattling sense and all of this. I don't have a dog in the hunt, but I do have a grasp of realpolitik, and I do have a grasp that nation-states, despite what you may think and what you may wish, when you click your red ruby slippers together, will always act in their own self-interest. And mind you, if one keeps on pressing the issue with Iran, as America and the West has done, they make it so that Iran's perception of America and Israel and the West as the great Satan becomes real in their minds because of the behavior of America towards them since 1979. Arguably, I would say that when it comes to monstrous misbehavior, the CIA helped to install and train the SAVAK, the Bureau for Intelligence and Security of the State, which has a Persian name that I cannot pronounce, and I'm not going to torture the language to even tell you what that is. According to a declassified CIA memo citing a classified U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee report, the CIA played a significant role in establishing SAVAK, providing both funding and training. At its peak, SAVAK reportedly employed approximately 5,000 agents operating under the Pahlavi dynasty. Iranian-American scholar and ex-politician Ghulam Reza Afkami estimates the SAVAK had between 4,000 and 6,000 members, while Time stated in a publication in 1979 that they had 5,000 members. I would remind you that between 1953 and 1971, the SAVAK had a savage reputation, but that savage reputation took a turn for even more ruthless brutality after a Marxist attack on a gendarmerie post in the Caspian village of Siakal by a small band of armed Marxists in February 71, in which a Shia cleric was tortured to death. That would be Ayatollah Mohammad Reza Saeed in 1970. According to Iranian political historian Ervind Ebrahamian, after this attack, SAVAK investigators were sent abroad for scientific training to prevent unwanted deaths from brute force. Brute force was supplemented with the bastinado, which was sleep deprivation, extensive solitary confinement, glaring searchlights, standing in one place for hours on end, nail extraction, snakes favored for use with women, electrical shocks with cattle prods, often in the rectum, cigarette burns sitting on hot grills, acid dripped into nostrils, near drownings, mock executions, and an electric chair with a large metal mask to muffle screams while amplifying them for the victim. This latter contraption was dubbed the Apollo, an allusion to the American spacecraft of the same name. Prisoners were also humiliated by being raped, urinated on, and forced to stand naked. Despite the new scientific methods, the torture of choice remained the traditional bastinado used to beat soles of the feet. The primary goals of those using the bastinados was to locate arms caches, safe houses, and accomplices. Abrahamian estimates that SAVAK and other police and military killed 368 guerrillas, including the leadership of the major urban guerrilla organizations, which then would be the Organization of Iranian Peoples, Fedai Guerrillas, People's Mujahideen of Iran, such as Hamid Ashraf, between 71 and 77, and executed up to 100 political prisoners between 71 and 79, the most violent era of the SAVAK's existence. Now, I don't say these things to justify what the mullahs and the clerics did in the 1979 seizure of said country, but one must know that from 1953 to 1979, it wasn't exactly the posh and pleasurable existence that one would imagine under Western auspices, having sponsored the coup in Iran in the first place, it being the CIA. Now, writing at the end of the Shah's overthrow, Time magazine on February 1979 described SAVAK as having, quote, long been Iran's most hated and feared institution, which had tortured and murdered thousands of the Shah's opponents. The Federation of American Scientists also found it guilty of the torture and execution of thousands of political prisoners, and symbolizing the Shah's rule from 63 to 79, Why they used the date of 63 to 79, I'm not quite certain, since that rule started in 1953. The fast list of Slavic torture methods included a lot of what I described earlier. And remember, some of those torture methods would raise their ugly heads via the CIA yet again in the policies that were imposed on prisoners during the global war on terror, in the wars on Iraq, Afghanistan, the Horn of Africa, Libya, Syria, and Yemen. There is no doubt in my mind that under the religious imprimatur of the revolution that made the secular state not so secular after the takeover in 1979, that whatever the variant is of Slavic, a secret police, in addition to most likely a Sharia police that would be instituted, have probably harassed, intimidated, and tortured tens of thousands, speculatively. So I want to make it clear that I am not an apologist for the Iranian regime, but I am real enough to know that we have a tiger by the tail when it comes to Iran that is, in my mind, impervious to ground invasion with what the present forces are available to the U.S. and its allies, and to include the Lilliputian forces of Israel proper, not to mention the projection problems that one would have, not to mention the problems one would have with the mountainous terrain in Iran proper, not to mention the BRICS relationship with Russia and China and the rest that are joining that coalition of the willing because of the decades of wars of choice by the U.S. that has given them opportunities, if not choices, to get into these kind of alliances in a world that we are told is peaceful in the West, but not so peaceful through United States in coalition action planet-wide, as we've seen, for instance, during that global war on terror from 2001 to the present day. After 1979, while members of Slavic were hunted, it appeared that when the talent stacks were observed by the new coalition government, this religious government in Iran, they took Slavic and they called it something else, and it turned into Savama, which is the Ministry of Intelligence of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and they employed these very people who had previously done awful things to the population so that they could do awful things to the population. My analysis indicates that, technologically speaking, besides the backwards-looking technology on occasion that one sees in Iranian public relations, that thanks to the assistance and collaboration with Russia and China, they punch above their intellectual and engineering weight when it comes to their capability to build very sophisticated war machines. This would not be tanks, this would not be ships or anything like that. But when it comes to missilery, as a variant of artillery, they have developed ICBMs, IRBMs. I would probably speculate that they have been in very close cooperation with the Russians to develop their own variations of the Oreshnik conventionally tipped IRBMs and ICBMs, and we're seeing some evidence of that in Israel. I think that Israel has bit off far more than it can chew, having always been, as I stipulated since 1973, a military paper tiger that is wholly reliant on the United States as the one that always steps in when they find themselves in the hazard. I find that regardless of the administration's political flavor, getting involved in Israel's wars is never a good idea for America and its Western counterparts, because it consistently gets the U.S. embroiled in these Middle Eastern food fights that, for the most part, never satisfy themselves with the kind of completion in which the resolution serves all parties, all trade-offs and compromises are met, and everybody clicks their red rupee slippers and says that the world is our apple and everything is going to be just right and very rosy. That's not the case at all. This is a brutal civilizational fight. between a number of competitors, whether it is the Sunni Wahhabist menace emanating out of Saudi Arabia, the Shia Crescent under fire from said menace, and then the recent interloper with the very well-endowed relationships with the United States, Israel in this case, constantly picking fights with regional and sub-regional hegemons that happen to be contiguous or close to it, and trying to ameliorate that threat through military or other asymmetric means, such as what recently happened with the pagers and the mass slaughter, if not injury, of leaders of Hamas, to evidently having Israelis with Iranians who happen to be allied with them in Iran proper, helping to stage assassinations and sabotage within the scientific, engineering, and missile infrastructure in Iran proper. I want to draw your attention to something else, and I'd like to single out one of my correspondents and contributors by the name of TC. I'd like to thank him for this. He talks about the ethnic makeup and distribution of Iranians and why that's important, and these boundaries and the mix or the density of these ethnicities and cultures and their densities within the regions and rural versus urban proximities is also of key importance. And this is a riff off of what I've talked about again and again about regional conflict complexes and the fact that when external countries invade or hit or bomb certain areas, it can set off a train of events or a cavalcade of effects that were nothing like what was speculatively authored by those who invaded and bombed, and turns into something else entirely. When you look at the demographic mixes there, there aren't simply Persians, even though they are the majority. There's Tats, there's Arabs, there's Azeris, there's Kurds, there's Lurs, Mazanis, Turkmen, Balakh, Gilak, and Kakhski. I would urge you to take a look at an ethnicity makeup map of Iran if you get the opportunity, and what you find, as with so many other Middle Eastern countries, is that when Churchill drew these map lines from 1918 to 1922, with the assistance of the Ministry for Foreign Affairs in the UK and other folks from Western allies, they made these map lines that were very linear and mathematical, regardless of clan, blood, and overweening ethnicity makeups and mashups within the regions, creating these kind of cauldrons and boiling points of forcing people to live in administrative nation states that they had no desire to do whatsoever. One can look at everything from Turkey to Afghanistan to Iraq and now Iran, and you see the same thing. And what happens here with this kind of interference, especially in the western reaches where it's most mountainous, and all of a sudden there's a ground invasion, and that ground invasion disproportionately affects folks who had no say whatsoever in what the government in Tehran had done to rattle sabers and get involved in conflicts and all of these kind of things. And then you are able to set their minds and souls against the invader. As a result of that, uniting them not against what may have been viewed as an internal foe, as was so often the case in Afghanistan, in which every time one stepped out of Kabul, you discovered that the country of Afghanistan was a Western fiction because it did not exist for anyone who existed within the confines of what we call Afghanistan as Afghans themselves in those areas, because blood, clan, and family relationships came first and foremost in forming who they were. These are all part and parcel to the hubris of Western invasion of Middle Eastern countries, and one can extend this, of course, to Eastern countries. For instance, what happened in Vietnam after both the French and the U.S. managed to get themselves involved in conflicts in which they had neither the cultural IQ nor the willingness to understand that those countries subject to invasion would not submit, would not take a knee, and would violently go their own way despite the overwhelming and overweening firepower of especially the U.S., but more so the French. But the French, of course, discovered in 1954 at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu that despite their technological savvy and materiel superiority, they could not defeat the Vietnamese communist forces at the time. The same thing will obtain itself in an invasion of Iran if that misfortune takes place, as America and its allies discovered in Iraq and Afghanistan, where in the case of Afghanistan, after nearly two decades of being there, they accomplished practically nothing. And the Taliban, which had been attempting to best presidents since the 1990s, managed to best its fourth president and send the United States military machine, the juggernaut, packing with its tail between its legs. As John Mearsheimer correctly points out, what does Israel seek to benefit from doing this, from picking a fight with a country that is not only so much larger than itself, but even in isolation, regardless of alliance, would still be a big dog to fight and ultimately a big dog to lose a fight to, especially if an invasion occurred? But why pick a fight with one that has a very solid and deep alliance with Russia and China and other gargantuan technology benefactors who I suspect will not be feeble in their support to Iran if this war heats up into a hot war that continues? And this brings us to what I find to be probably some of the most unpleasant aspects as far as being an American in America, is that what if after these years of unsupervised illegal immigration by the tens of millions, as I have emphasized in my Storming America series, where I talk about what's going to happen if there is an upsized and upgunned October 7th, 2023 Gaza-style incursion into Israel that happens on one Tuesday morning here in America simultaneously across the country, where, to make the math easy, 10,000 men, 1,000 10-man cells comprised of, could be Sunni, could be Shia, could be Iranians, could be Hamas, could be Hezbollah, could be combinations thereof, of Islamists who are basically fire-and-forget weapon systems that are launched one fated Monday or Tuesday morning onto their intended targets in the United States. They demand no command and control because, given munition sets and their capability to turn vehicles into munition sets, especially if they have the accompanying explosive devices and are rather good in a MacGyver fashion at exploiting the possibilities of what can be used to really wreck what's around them, they fire and forget because they don't have to be commanded, because the only thing that they have to do is kill and maim until they no longer have the capacity to do so, and they are either apprehended, injured, or killed themselves. I would suspect that being injured and killed themselves would be what they would elect to do if that were to happen. I feel as if Iran, not quite having the intercontinental capability, nor circular error probability, nor the material number needed to lob conventional or nuclear weapons into the U.S. or Europe proper, may use this rather inexpensive means to expand their asymmetric and hybrid fight to have a really disproportionate impact, much like what happened on 9/11 with the towers, the Pentagon, and the aborted attempt against apparently the White House for an investment by UBL of less than, I think, $1 to $2 million, whatever the case may be. Were Western ICs running interference for that? I have no idea. It did happen. And of course, as UBL described in the fatwa, he claimed, and I paraphrase, that the West would not only bankrupt itself, not only would it spend tens of billions of dollars, but it would invade Middle Eastern countries to set them against us forever and eternal. Well, it turns out that those fatwas were true, and that's exactly what happened. And that is my greatest fear in all of this, because I don't have a dog in the fight in these foreign wars, but I have a big dog in the fight when it comes to the United States, because I and my family happen to live here. And I see that with the saber rattling and the assistance to other nation states, the American empire, once again, is trying to stick its nose where it doesn't belong and put its index finger in the chest of various countries to tell them submit, yield, kneel, or else. And I don't think that the second and third order effects, Newton's third law being a stone cold motherfracker, that the U.S. policy establishment, State Department, the DOD, does not have the crystal ball it thinks it has invested in that its predictive and forecasting frameworks are rather rusty and terrible, as evidenced by what has occurred as a result of CIA covert and clandestine action since its formation in 1948 around the world, where in 1953, when the Shah of Iran was installed, there was no one in that year who could predict that in 1979, all of a sudden, after a quarter of a century of rule by the Shah, it would come to a blistering and bloody end and be replaced by something that was iniquitous and completely counter to the neutrality or benefit of the U.S. and allied national security establishment. I think again and again, there is a trend line here, a pattern that no one in the DOS and the DOD and all of the mandarins in the federal government are paying attention to. And that's the fact that every time America has made war since 1945, not only is that sterling track record of frailty, stalemate, and defeat intact, but that it causes America to have so many more enemies than it would have had if it hadn't meddled. As I say in one of my favorite movies, Serenity, based on the terrific TV series Firefly, River is asked, well, what causes all these problems among people? And she responds with the classic two-word response, they meddle. M-E-M-E-D-D-L-E, the United States and its alliances meddle. And that meddle causes a cavalcade of calamities in anti-fragile and fragile ecologies that leads to a world that is fractured, fraught with war, and unsurprisingly, finds America's longtime foes, China and Russia, more powerful than they've ever been as a result of the martial and diplomatic incompetence of the U.S. establishment and its curious relationship with a tiny country called Israel that has caused so much Middle Eastern turmoil. I feel as if Iran, in this case, is going to be a canary in a coal mine in a very large fashion. And that the more involved militarily the U.S. invests in a coming conflagration in Iran, the worse off everyone on Earth, especially the United States, are going to be. Thanks for listening. This is Bill, and I appreciate your solicitude. And if you get the opportunity to recommend this podcast, if you like it, to friends, family, colleagues, acquaintances and such, I would be ever obliged if you happen to be listening to this on your favorite podcast vendor. Please leave stars, or if you get a chance, leave a detailed narrative review. I would always be obliged. And again, stand by as my sound improvement project is going to array itself with Chasing Ghosts. I'll start at episode one, make my way through all the episodes to improve the quality of the podcast. And of course, moving forward, I will not publish without running it through Chris's magic box to make sure that I have the fidelity that will appeal to the ancient audiophile ears that I have. So with that, again, thanks for your support. Thanks for your comments when you visit me on Substack, where I publish so that I can have a conversation with my listeners. And thanks so much. This is Bill out.